And I also want to start by acknowledging the traditional territory in which we have the privilege of being on this, when it's raining, it's a beautiful day too, because, you know, it represents, and I always think on Prisoner Justice Day, when it's raining, it's symbolic of the tears of many and the tears of, and the loss of so many people. So, and I want to thank you very much for inviting me. It's an honor to be invited, and I will apologize because I have to go because I'm committed to things in Toronto tonight and tomorrow, and so I'm racing there, and then I have to go do some things in Calgary as well, and it's a busy time just because of what we're talking about. You know, it's my pleasure, and thank you for the contribution to the Ashley Smith Memorial Bursary. We have bursaries because education, post-secondary education, was cut for prisoners in 1992 at the federal level, and in most provincial and territorial jails it never has existed. We have bursaries so that women who are inside, who have been inside, who have been criminalized, can access education resources. So the money that has been contributed will go to that. So thank you very much for that. So I was asked to talk a bit about some of the strategies, what's happening, and on some of the strategies. And I was struck today, the people I was staying with, friends here, I was speaking with them. They're friends also of Claire Culhane, and I don't know, many of you will know the name Claire Culhane. She started her activism here in Montreal, organizing garment workers back in the 20s, 30s, and into the 40s. Then went to Vietnam and worked as a nurse. After being fired from Ontario hospitals because she refused to not remove, it was called stealing, but remove materials from the private ward so that those on the public wards could access them. She was fired. She then went to Vietnam, saw that Canada did not have clean hands, came back, protested, chained herself to the hill for that act of civil disobedience, was criminalized, and then became interested in her late 40s, early 50s in prison issues, and was the first to commemorate Prison Justice Day outside the walls of a prison. So she did that in British Columbia outside the then BC Penitentiary, and she died in 1996. And so I had forgotten that the friends I was staying with actually were also friends of Claire's, and we talked a bit about that because I know them from another context. The fact that I routinely get calls designed to threaten when I'm traveling to know who's funding what I'm doing, and the requests are coming from the Minister Tave's office, and sometimes I'm told the Prime Minister's office, are an indication of the sort of pressures that are coming. If that's what's coming to me, you can only imagine, and I've just told you some of what's happening for those who are actually living it. So one of the strategies I want to underscore is those who are at greatest risk, we should not be putting in the forefront on these challenges, because those who are at the greatest risk of either further criminalization or further incarceration are in fact facing that now. In the past 5 to 10 years, we've talked about that threat. It's actually happening in a very real way now. And so the criminalization of dissent is very real. Yet, some of you may have seen this past week that our government gave a free pardon to men who were called our friends, our neighbors, the farmers, who had protested the Canada Wheat Board. So had protested a law that was about creating more egalitarian and equal opportunities for all farmers and for those in the West. And those men who chose to cross the border, knowing that it was against the law, chose to sell their wheat at a greater profit in the United States, who were then criminalized as a result of it. And I'm not supporting criminalizing anybody, that's not what I'm suggesting, or criminalizing for doing, but they chose to do that, then chose not to pay the fines that they were allocated, then therefore ended up in prison, were pardoned and given a free pardon in a way that is not even legally possible right now. And the question everybody should be asking is, how could that happen? Why did it happen? Because they're a certain person's friend? And he could invoke the royal prerogative of mercy in a context where it was never intended to be used. What about all the men, and some women, but especially men, who are convicted of sodomy and sit on sex offender registries now because at the time they were convicted, sodomy was still in the criminal code? I'm talking about gay men who were arrested, criminalized, some of them detained, many of them jailed. Who now, that is no longer law. Why didn't they get the same benefit? If the theory is now, because Harper abolished the wheat board, these men should not have been criminalized for something that would no longer be seen as a crime. why aren't the doctors and the women who had abortions at a time when it was still illegal to have abortions in this country, and be prepared, it may be again, that's certainly on the order papers, why haven't they been given royal prerogative of mercy? Because their convictions still sit in their on their records. Why have those who had small portions of pot and were convicted before this possession laws were changed not been given a royal prerogative of mercy? The list goes on and on. So we have, and now the self-defense law just changed. Why not all the women who are in jail for defending themselves against abusive men, have they not been not only given pardons but freed from prison, because many of them are still in prison? And so you see the hypocrisy of deciding that one law, that not only do you announce we're changing the law, but at the same time you announce we're changing the law, we're pardoning 10 people who we consider not criminals but our friends. Think of the hypocrisy of that, and we're not causing any challenge to that. Now, we're here to talk about prison justice day, but I think it had to be said that we're in this moment, and if you need more information about how what was just done could not legally be done, just email me, and we're in the midst of trying to get some of the media, the mainstream media, and obviously media is already interested. I did an interview yesterday with the Kingston, the Queen's radio station, so there's a lot of course, university media and alternative media are interested, but we also want it to get into the mainstream, because people should know that individuals who are criminalized now should have the same benefit at the very least as those 10 farmers were given just last week. So the announcement was made, they changed the law, and they pardoned people. And they pardoned them after, you'll remember, that we actually don't have pardons in this country anymore. Is there anyone who didn't know that? Last year, we changed it. There are no longer any pardons in this country. They are now record suspensions. So he gave something that he actually just took away. And when he was given the advice that he couldn't give those, he said, well, tell me how I can do it. And the only way he could do it was a royal prerogative of mercy, which is essentially invoking the power of the crown, the queen, to say, we no longer consider you criminal. A free pardon. So a provision that doesn't even exist in our law. In addition, some of the farmers, a couple of them said, we don't know why we're getting this. They didn't even know. They didn't ask for it. Now, to ask for a pardon in this country now will cost you a minimum of $631, because they just increased the charges as well this past year. In fact, in the last 2.5 years, they've increased it twice. It used to be, it was a standard, it was seen as your right. If you had been in the community after your record was expunged, after you had served your sentence for a period of time, 5 or 10 years, depending on what it was for, to be able to just apply for a pardon, and there was no cost, because it was seen as, and in fact, many of us were agitating, continue to say, it shouldn't even be an application process. In some countries, it's automatic, that if you, once you've been out and your sentence is finished for a certain period of time, you should be considered to be free and clear of that record. Why should it haunt you for another 5, 10, 15, or the rest of your life? And so that's what we had been advocating, and it hadn't been supported. So when you hear stories like that, it's important, I think, for all of us to challenge it. And a few people have already written their members of Parliament and said, how did this happen? And if you want a sample of an email to send to your Member of Parliament, I encourage you to do it. What they're sending back shows that even the MPs don't know what happened. And so we're accumulating that to try and publicize it. And that's the big message, I would say, is we have to be very transparent. Many people have said, I have the privilege and responsibility of this job. I have the privilege and responsibility of an education. At a time, I come from a working class background. The education that I have and the job I have now, I would not be able to do now. I know that. The protest, my red square I just gave away, so I'll need to get another one while I'm here. But I just recently was speaking to the students who were graduating the University of Ottawa, and we talked about the importance of the protests that started here, and the Occupy protests and the Occupy movement, because we need to be rising up and not being silent. And it's too it's not easy, but too many people are being silenced. And certainly the reason I mentioned at the outset the questions come about who's funding what I'm doing is I want it to be public, because we have no doubt that we'll continue to be attacked. And in fact, one of the things that has happened since the attacks is credentials that I previously have refused, I have accepted this past year, what I call my straight credentials, an honorary thing, and governor general thing, things that a number of people said we were surprised. In fact, when I was called by the president of University of Ottawa about whether I'd accept it, his question was, I hope you accept it, because he knows that I usually wouldn't. And part of the reason I'm doing that is also to provide some of that buffer. And I challenge you to challenge me if I ever sound like I'm ever shutting up on these issues, because it's one of the things that we have to be able to do. Many of the organizations that I work with nationally, I'm with the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, and I teach part-time at the law school at the University of Ottawa. And I have a privilege of a paycheck because I also had the privilege of education. And what I meant by saying that I couldn't get this education now, I couldn't have 5 degrees and still be working for a nonprofit organization and support as a single mom supporting 2 kids. I mean, I have a partner too, but she doesn't live with me. And so I support, I'm a sole support of those children. And I couldn't do that now because I would have had to have a debt load that would not allow me to work in a nonprofit. I would have had to take some other kind of job, or choose to be in a situation that would also put my kids at increased risk of not having health care and the educational supports they need. So I recognize that privilege. I own it, and I recognize the privilege of the job I have and the responsibility of it. As some of you know, we have gone for periods of time without funding, but we do currently have funding, and I don't take that lightly. So we need to keep talking out, and if I ever stop talking, or you think I haven't spoken enough on something, please do challenge me, because I don't deserve my paycheck if I'm not speaking out. And it is unnerving, frustrating, horrifying. I often talk about vibrating between rage and despair at the number of individuals and groups that have been silenced over the past number of years, both through their own decisions, but not. I mean, we just had the HIV/AIDS Legal Network have 75% of the funds that they were hoping to get for projects cut and eliminated. We know that that's a huge voice for women and men in prison, and that's going to be a huge loss. So that's what I mean by it's not always their choice, but certainly we must keep speaking out. And I think the more we speak out, the more we actually do protect. Although, it's not without its risks, and hence the reason I'm saying make sure we keep those who have the greatest to lose protected in those situations, and those of us who have the greatest privilege take do the work we have to do. So what are some of the things that I see that are working? I see that the protests that... Yes. Yes, sorry. Okay. Thank you for... I'm talking too loud. My daughter's always telling me that I'm yelling too loud everywhere in the train station, where she was telling me that as I was yapping on the phone. My son isn't here, but I don't know if any of you... some of you have met my son. He's now 22 and absolutely opposed to education. When he was first starting to read, he decided that he shouldn't actually have to go to school anymore. He should be able to teach himself. And that'll give you a taste of where he's at now. And he continues to do all kinds of things and has refused to finish grade 12 because he read Paulo Freire and Deterre when he was about 12 and decided that the pedagogy of the oppressed really, was the first prison that defined school as the first prison. But I did tell him I was going to bring him with us. This is a T-shirt he did for one of the early days, and some of the women who had known Michael since he was a baby put it on a T-shirt in 1997. So he was he would come and listen to events, and this he did when he was about 4, drew it and put it on everything and got in trouble for writing on the walls. And so one of the women took a picture of it and then put it on a T-shirt. So I just last year I gave away all my political T-shirts because a number of the women who were in the halfway house in Ottawa were over for dinner and saw them hanging there and said, you can't wear all those possibly. And so I said, okay, take what you want. So I have none. That's the only t-shirt I have left. And I, one of them had this, and they said, oh, isn't that Michael? And I said, yeah. So I said, just leave that one for me, please. So so I just thought I'd bring that and share that with us. So that's Michael here with us. And he is in solidarity with the protests about education, as I mentioned. And he also said that he... you know, one of the things that is very frustrating to him is to see the lack of opportunities for young people increasingly here, not just selfishly for him, because he could have opportunities and is choosing to some alternate lifestyle choices. And I think, you know, it's taken his mother a long time to, you know, after going through, you know, what I went through, the fact that he has opportunities that others don't have has been a challenge for me to accept. But I'm there now, and he's a, I'm proud and privileged to have him as a son. So, but the other thing I want to talk about is the way in which we need to be challenging the decimation of community initiatives and decimation of community projects and the decimation of social programs, healthcare, education. And when we're talking about deaths in custody, it's really clear how much that has impacted. I mean, many of you will know the story of Ashley Smith, the young woman who died while being observed on suicide watch. And right now, another friend of mine, whose wife committed suicide. She was a lifer who committed suicide in because they would not release her. She was jailed in December because she was suicidal. And then they wouldn't let her go home because they decided she was suicidal. And she killed herself because she didn't believe she'd ever get home. He is now on suicide watch, having been jailed himself, dealing with the aftermath of the tragedy of that loss himself. And so I don't know many deaths in custody that, I don't know of any that weren't preventable, and I don't know of many that would not have occurred had the individuals not been in prison. There are some unnatural deaths that are due to other incidents that were happening in the prisons, but deaths like Ashley Smith, deaths like the men who, Eddie Tallon, who were, you know, started the whole commemoration for prisoners of Prisoner Justice Day, are all unnecessary, all preventable, and should be reminding us that we need to first and foremost be keeping people in the community and ensuring they can stay in community, not in ending up having them in prison cells where they're languishing. And the increased numbers of people with mental health issues, I use it purposely, that term, not to in any way imply there's an issue for those individuals, but it's issues that we have to deal with that get developed in prison. As I often say, who wouldn't be depressed when they go to prison? I mean, it's the people who are going into prison who don't sometimes know where they are, who cause many of us, you know, even more increased anguish. I mean, women who are asking, a woman I just met last time I was at Grand Valley Institution, who couldn't figure out how to find me when she was sent by staff to meet with me, and said she didn't really like this group home. So imagine how you could end up with someone being criminalized who doesn't even know they're in a prison. How could they be criminalized in the first place, let alone be institutionalized, when they don't even know they're in a prison? And that's not the first. The first woman I met who asked me a question similar to that was in prison for women. And every prison since then, every women's prison, and certainly many of the men's and young prisons where young people are that I visited over the years, same sorts of things have happened. So we never have prisons full of wealthy people. So we have Conrad Black, well. And so we have the two guys who created the, here in Quebec, who they created laws that don't even impact them, so-called white-collar crime laws. We know that who gets criminalized are those who are most dispossessed, most depressed, most marginalized, the poorest, those who are racialized, those who are struggling with the post-trauma of abuse, neglect, who self-medicate, who are medicated themselves by institutions, so-called health institutions, before they end up in the system. That's who's in prison. And those of you who do this work know that. So I think we need to be also trying to figure out, to a friend of mine, Erica, who's Canadian but is working and living and organizing in Chicago right now, and other throughout the continent as well, but is organizing, says, you know, we need to be figuring out how to really touch people's feelings and emotions. And I don't usually do that in this work because I'm already said, I often vibrate between rage and despair. And one of the things, a woman who I'm going to see tomorrow said to me after she got out and came to our office and works with us now. She's, as many of you know, the women who work with me in the office, I don't have a criminal record. I haven't been criminalized, although I have family who have. I don't pretend to have that lived experience, and but have generally had someone serving a life sentence working with me until they're ready to move into another position or to, and we've got a woman who's coming back who likely will eventually take over this position. And but she said to me, you know, it's important that you don't show all those emotions when you're inside, because it actually creates a hope for us that in fact you have answers every time. And that was a bit scary to me to hear, that the idea that my going in and what I think of as very clearly figuring out what the issue is, figuring out how to document it, figuring out a strategy, get at it, go through, is actually a creation of hope inside. But outside of that environment, the only thing that I've found that can really effectively change things is when you actually touch people at an emotional level. And we're actually dealing with a government that has figured out how to do that in the flip way very, very effectively, to capture people's feelings of anger, rage, greed, and vengeance, and to appeal to that. And when you asked me to come up with strategy, to talk about strategies, I think I probably said, if I didn't say it to you, I said it to everybody since, I wish I knew. You guys are coming up with better strategies than I can think of. And things that are, I mean, some of the things that people have told me have been more effective of late that I've said publicly are when I'm starting to encourage people to think about, what would you rather have our money spent on? Because it's our money that the government is spending. Would you rather have it spent on what the parliamentary budget officer put in place by the government, now ignored by the government, because they've held up a mirror to the government and said, you could be Harvard educating every single person in prison and many more in the population for what you're spending to incarcerate people, the majority of whom are not a risk to public safety if you release them today. And so they said, the parliamentary budget officer, Kevin Page, said the $343,000 per year it costs on average to jail a woman in this country and in the federal penitentiary system could be better spent in the community, could be better spent to ensure that there is subsidized education. Because we know that countries, not many left anymore because of globalization, but countries that have had free education systems, free health care, universally accessible health care and social services, and adequate livable, heaven forbid we got guaranteed livable incomes, have actually had the safest communities and the lowest crime rates. Women are the fastest growing prison population in this country and around the world, in most and certainly most northern countries and so-called Western countries. And there are a bunch of reasons for that. There's not one clear reason. Certainly the government has been saying, the numbers have not gone up in prisons. They have. So just two bills alone. So I'm going to work backwards. So the more recent is the bill that I was mentioning, the one so-called white-collar crime bill that got rid of accelerated parole. Accelerated parole release, and the reason those two men got access to it, or in theory did, one didn't get out on it, one did. The reason that they had access to it was because it was set up for nonviolent first-time offenders. It's not a term I use, that's why I'm using quote, but that's what the law said. So one of them was able to access that those provisions, and that was the reason for the repeal of the law. It When I called up corrections and said, how many women are going to be impacted by this? I called up the day it was being passed, and I thought they'd tell me 30 or 40 women. Anybody take a guess how many women they said?
500.
That would be close, but because there were almost 600 women in federal custody that day, or just over 600 in federal custody, 100 women were immediately impacted. So when you think a bill that they said would not impact many people impacted the imprisonment immediately of 100 women who otherwise would have been eligible for accelerated parole. And what does that mean? Well, what it meant was accelerated parole meant there was a presumption that if you were first time in and it was a nonviolent offense, that you could be considered for parole and be released on that date unless there were reasons that you, Correctional Service of Canada, thought you shouldn't be. So it wasn't automatic, as was being put out there in the media. It was not automatic at all. And if there were any concerns, you were sent to the parole board. The parole board made the decision. And the parole board has really become a detention board, not a releasing board. It was set up to be a releasing board, but it's essentially become a detention board. And many of the people on it, many of the new appointments, are former police officers, former corrections people. And in some parts of the country, there have been very few releases with certain members of the parole board. So that was what that provision was for. So that meant right away, those who would normally be reviewed, and for women, they were mostly in on fraud-related charges. So what does that mean? It means they were in on poverty-related offenses. If there's no offense for being poor, at least, you know, articulated as such, but if you're doing something, if you're poor and trying to survive on the social assistance, you know that even in this province, thank you, even in this province, which has the best of the worst across the country, you cannot survive on social assistance. What you get on what used to be called welfare, nowhere in this country can you survive. So just by being on social assistance, you're infinitely criminalizable. And so who's predominantly on social assistance? Well, there's a lot of men on social assistance too, but overwhelmingly we have women who have been reliant on social assistance, often single moms, often sole supports of their families. And so an infinitely criminalizable group. And Margaret Little, if any of you know her work out of Kingston, has done a lot of work on this area and has documented situations where women who were just eating at their mother's homes every second weekend and being given groceries by their mothers have been criminalized for welfare fraud. And so when we're talking about why are we seeing so many in, we're talking about, yeah, I know it's hard to imagine, right? Because they costed out what the groceries would be and determined that she had an overpayment, so you had to pay it back. And the only place where debt is considered income is for people on assistance. So the poorest of the poor, if you borrow money, is considered income. If you're given gifts, it's considered income. And if you don't declare it, you can be criminalized for it. You can be deemed to have an overpayment and be criminalized. Imagine, so we need to publicize this and get people thinking about it. How fair is it that if you borrow money as a poor person on social assistance, it's considered income, and you don't get a credit when you pay it back? So think of what would happen if we suddenly said, we should have that. Mr. Harper, isn't that a great tax? I'm not serious here because, you know, I support taxes, but, well, actually, maybe I should be serious about it. So if you have a mortgage, those of you who have mortgages out there, then that should all be taxable. Not like the U.S., where you get a tax advantage for having mortgages, but, you know, it should be, if you are on social assistance, you can't even have a house. You can't own a house with a bank. So if you get every loan you get as someone who has income and is paying taxes, you should be also paying taxes on the loans. You know, imagine the hue and cry. I mean, it would never pass. But why does it get through when it's people on social assistance? Because they don't have the same power and authority with those who are in the governing parties, classes, to be able to exert that power. And they're loath to be the ones stand up. The vilification of the poor and the shame that goes with, whether it's poverty, mental health, all the issues we're talking about, is very real. And so we end up seeing nobody wanting to stand up. And I have, you know, a very, you know, personal example of that I don't use publicly because the person impacted doesn't want to be known publicly. But if you can imagine, there was a time when I was threatened with criminalization for paying, putting money towards rent for an individual on assistance. I characterize it as a gift to her children. It used to be you could do that in Ontario. You can't do it anymore. It used to be you could characterize it as a gift and not have to have it declared. That rule changed. I didn't know about it. The person didn't know about it. The worker who retired didn't know about it. The new worker came in, had more facility with computers. Everything was computerized, punched in all the numbers, and up came a flag, potential fraud, potential overpayment case. Call the person in, ask her, you know, how are you paying this rent? Well, so-and-so gives me a gift every month to my children, and that's how we pay the rent, so I can stay in this community and my kids can stay in that school and we don't have to move again, and da-da-da. And response was, that's fraud. And they started an investigation to lay charges against the woman, me, and the former welfare worker. Well, you can imagine my response. Make my day. I would love for it to be the headline in the Globe and Mail or the National Pest to have, you know, head of E-Fry, part-time professor of law school, charged with welfare fraud for making a gift of part of someone's rent. Guess who didn't want it publicized? That woman. For the shame it would be for her children to be exposed in school as being kids on welfare, for the shame, the risk that would put her kids and her for potential intervention by child welfare authorities, the risk to her children of being singled out as now any issue that came up being a problem because they were kids, welfare kids. Those are all real. I'm not dismissing those as unimportant. They were very real. But that would have probably stymied us doing it. As it turned out, the more you talk about these things, people actually sometimes, I don't know if they would be now, but at that time, we're talking a few years back now, people were shamed and we threatened to charge an abusive process, abuse of power, you know, all the things that could potentially be levied against the government. And guess what they did? They just stopped the process. So they never did proceed with charges. They did demand that it stop, and she did have to move, and she did have to move her children into a different school. So it wasn't a success by any stretch, but she wasn't criminalized. Those are not great successes, but we do need to be talking about them more, and we do need to figure out ways to protect those individuals in those situations, but expose those injustices. So that's just one example of how we've seen the feminization and then the criminalization of poverty. So there is nowhere in this country that someone who is living on social assistance could not be criminalized if they were monitored, and documented, and then those documents were brought to the authorities and charges were laid. So that's one group. And of course, women are overrepresented there. Or women will do things that that will cause them to be criminalized because of their attempts to survive poverty, whether that's selling their bodies, whether that's selling drugs, whether it's, you know, carrying packages across town, across borders, all of those things. And so we see increased numbers of women in jail for those charges as well, which is, you know, still about the feminization and criminalization of poverty. And then we see, of course, Aboriginal women who have been abandoned, or worse, with colonization. We've seen the first jails were for women and men and young people were reserves, and that indigenous peoples were placed in, not usually their land. They're moved off their land, moved into a land that was seen as less valuable to settlers and to the colonizers. And so were shunted off to that land until they couldn't leave unless they had the authority of the Indian agents. So the first wardens were really, prison wardens were Indian agents. And some of the first women imprisoned at the prison for women in Kingston, people have done that research, Kelly Hannah Moffat and others, who have said the first women were jailed, first Indigenous women that were jailed there, were jailed for failure to get medical attention when they're having children. Not because anything happened to their children, initially when people were researching this, they thought maybe the babies had died or something had happened. No, nothing had happened. These were women in acts of resistance trying to protect their children from what? A few years later, being taken into residential schools. So women would go into the bush, they would refuse to notify the Indian agent or the medical, so-called medical authorities. Sometimes it was a woman in their own community who was assisting, but who would then be required, in exchange for the food she got or the care she got or the housing she had, to report on her sister who had given birth. And so women would refuse to get assistance and go into hiding with their children to try and protect them. And, you know, some of the elders, many of them aren't alive anymore, but some of the elders that I've had the privilege of walking with over the past number of decades, some of them didn't actually know what their real age was because they were told repeatedly to keep saying they were four, they were four, they were four, they were four, and until they could no longer pass for four. I suppose when they're growing beards, they might not pass for four. Or, you know, sorry, that's a bad joke. But those were some of the first acts of resistance. And when you're documented from birth to death, which is what the Indian Act still does, then it's far easier to be kept track of, and it's far easier to be removed, either for school or for child welfare purposes, because you don't have your ideas of parenting or have a racial class biased overtone, that when you see a whole group of kids being cared for, or you see kids going in and out of different homes to get food or to sleep or whatever, that is somehow seen as not the quintessential nuclear family that was. So we see the 60s scoop, we now see more kids going into care than ever were taken in the 60s scoop or even into residential schools. And so we see that legacy continuing. And even now, even though now the so-called juvenile system, criminal system, and the child welfare system are supposed to be separate, those of you who know how those systems work know that often the same institutions have beds that are designated as, some of them as health, some of them as child welfare, some of them as custody beds. And so we end up seeing a trajectory right into, from child welfare right into the criminal justice, so-called justice, criminal injustice system. And once you're in there, it's very hard to ever get out. And it used to be that at least there'd be a break when you reached age and you were first charged as an adult. You'll see the media did a really good, this is good, bad, articulation of this and helped the government start to challenge all of these areas by, some of you remember when the Young Offenders Act first came in, they would say, we can't reveal the name of this individual who has done X, Y, or Z because they're protected under the Young Offenders Act. Did you ever see that under the Juvenile Delinquents Act? No. Nobody was allowed to report anything under the Juvenile Delinquents Act, and the minute the young person became of age, their record disappeared. So there was never any media weren't even allowed in the courtroom, so we never heard about it. Once the Young Offenders Act came in, they allowed media in the courtroom but wouldn't let them publish the names. And so the media's act of resistance, because it interfered with their, it interfered with capitalism, was that they started articulating that the reason we can't publish the names is because they're protected under the Young Offenders Act. And now all of those protections have gone. So we've seen this increased influx of individuals into the system, indigenous people into the system. And at the same time as we're seeing cuts and lack of resources, and the work of Cindy Blackstock around the lack of education services for young people is probably, a really great act of resistance that she's been doing to get kids actually articulating what they need and want in terms of education systems. And it's no accident that we've got increased numbers of Indigenous people being criminalized at the same time as we have communities that have no running water, no sewer systems at all, inadequate housing, inadequate food. And then we have this new, it's not new, but the whole notion that particularly in young Indigenous mothers are to blame now for this increased criminalization. So it's, that's not something I normally do. I better drink this before. So we have the increased criminalization of women. And some of you remember the G case in Manitoba of basically trying to criminalize mothers And we've seen it with the new legislation that, I've got a mental pause block on this, and lots of names, but this guy in particular, just because it was so, anyway, it was the law to try and make a fetus declared a person even before conception, I should say. Seriously, I mean, because you know, they characterize the pregnancy as 40 weeks. They said, you know, from the start of the 40-week period, which everybody knows is actually the last menstrual period women have had, that you could be criminalized if you took drugs or drank alcohol before that date and put in jeopardy the fetus. And, you know, so can imagine that you could now criminalize everybody before they even got pregnant. Imagine. Great policy. I mean, obviously it didn't go through, but, you know, it's one of the few that didn't go through that is equally, there are equally, ones
that. Pass in Arizona?
Pardon me?
Didn't that pass in Arizona, the fetus law?
Oh, God. Maybe. Sorry. No pun intended.
It's either still being debated or it's on there.
Oh, great. So it'll probably be back. So, but, you know, what we've seen how we've seen it end up with more women criminalized is not just that way, but also the notion that fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are overwhelmingly are labels that are attached to Indigenous kids. Now, if you see, when I was talking to pediatricians about this, when you see the shopping list of symptoms that can be classified as fetal alcohol, and same thing with ADHD and all these, when you see the shopping list of symptoms and you take it to a pediatrician, they say, you know, a greater risk really to particularly Indigenous kids is the environmental concerns of inadequate housing, inadequate nutrition, undrinkable water, you know, the fact that in some communities people are being given pop. Coke is easier to get than is milk because it stays longer. And as we've had environmental issues where we don't have ice bridges or ice roads in some communities now, they can't afford to fly in nutritious food because it goes bad too quickly. So you've got all the stuff that is likely to increase risk to not just children, but to adults and diabetes and all the issues they're raising. So instead of focusing on the challenges that are making these inhospitable environments, you hyper-responsibilize the people who have the least power over it. And so in this case, mothers. So we're also seeing this increased criminalization of women in ways that are more insidious. And so we're likely to see more women criminalized because of their inability to negotiate a different space. And it's no accident that when the Native Women's Association and a number of the Indigenous women urged the Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Issues and Human Rights to come and visit reserves in Canada, that our standard of living dropped from number one in the world to, I believe it's number seven, and I think we're back up to number five. We may even be at number three again now. But when you looked at Indigenous people alone and people on reserve, it dropped to below most of the developing countries. So that's in Canada, with one of the richest countries in the world in terms of, you know, gross domestic product and stuff. So we're seeing increased numbers of both women being criminalized, but also hyper-responsibilized. And it's a term that we started to use to try and characterize a lot of what's happening in not just social services, healthcare, education, but also in the prison system. So the notion that you can divest yourself of state responsibility to act, to resource, if you can say it's not our fault. It's that individual made that choice. So the woman chose to drink and therefore chose to have a child that now has challenges, whether it's learning or physical or whatever. So, or the woman chose to break the law. The woman chose to be poor. You know, you see what I'm talking. So that's one way that we've seen increased numbers of women. In addition, we've seen the backlash to violence against women. When I was first starting out as a young woman doing organizing, we were organizing around taking seriously that men could not beat their wives. When I was first starting this work, a man could not rape his wife. It was impossible. A woman could not deny her husband sex. So a woman could not claim rape, ever, if she was married to the man who raped her. So, you know, it's not like we've come a long way, really, Because how many times have you seen it taken seriously when a woman does call, not just because she's being raped, but because she's being beaten by... and, you know, it's not... And those laws developed at a time when women didn't have any rights, when women were the property of the men who were their fathers or the men who married them. So not a big surprise that's taken... You know, the law hasn't caught up in very real ways, and more importantly, that the attitudes haven't caught up at all. So... as we started to get mandatory charging, we thought that was an answer to say it's not okay to beat women and children, to beat anybody, but in particular when we're talking about violence against women. And what have we got? We've got a homogenized domestic violence responses, which means that if you're called and you actually go, if you're the police, you're just as likely to lay charges against the women, who in most cases would be the victim, as you are to lay charges against the man. And you're more likely to get guilty pleas from the women than you are from the men. And so we have a huge number of women in custody who have reacted to violence. I use the term purposely because I would argue almost all of it is self-defense. I would argue all of it is self-defense, in fact, but almost all of it for sure, even legally would be defined as self-defense. But they don't claim self-defense and they plead guilty. And more importantly, even some of their lawyers, who should know better in terms of legal defenses, don't see it as self-defense. And so we end up with increased numbers of women reacting to violence with, not increased numbers, sorry, increased numbers of those who have tried to defend themselves ending up with criminal records, and very serious criminal records, some of them. And I mean, we're intervening right now in the case of a woman who pled guilty to first-degree murder. She has an intellectual disability. She has mental health issues. She has a long, long history of abuse. She was taken in by the man she was co-accused with at 17. And he was 20 years her senior. Tell me that she was the most active agent in that situation. And yes, someone died, and yes, it's a tragedy. But the fact that she has been held as the person who was primarily responsible is outrageous. Some of you know Yvonne Johnson's case, another example. Three other co-accused, and she gets the most severe sentence. Why? Because the man who died was allegedly an abuser of children. And guess what? Who had the most motive to want to kill him? The woman who had been abused as a child, of course, and who had children who are at risk from this man. So she gets life 25, two co-accused get life 10, and the person who gives evidence against all three of them gets 18 months. So, you know, we see the backlash to violence against women as well. And so we see the countercharging. We also see that when women do act to defend themselves, particularly if they use lethal force, the full weight of the law comes down upon them, particularly if they're Indigenous women or racialized women, but generally. So I've already mentioned how the accelerated parole is impacted. The elimination of the 2-for-1, the credit for time served when you're awaiting trial. Now, right now, I actually don't know what it is here in Montreal, but across the country, the average is 75% of people in provincial and territorial jails are awaiting trial, or because they're considered foreign national and looking at potential deportation or being reviewed. 75%. So they're not found guilty, they're awaiting trial, or they're awaiting a review, immigration review. Okay? So 75%. So for sure, those individuals shouldn't be being penalized. If they ultimately are found guilty of whatever charge they're facing, they now no longer, well, they can actually, there's a loophole, and I'll tell you that strategy. If anybody you know has been picked up and charged, ask them to immediately ask for bail. And if their lawyer says you'll never get it, say, too bad, I still want to ask for it. Because if you've asked for it, you have the potential to get a credit of 1.5 days for every day served in your sentence. If you don't ask for it, you don't. So it's ludicrous. So does anybody know about it? Hardly anybody knows. Half the lawyers haven't read it. They don't know. And so if anybody gets arrested, immediately ask for a bail hearing. Have it documented, and if your lawyer won't do it, you know. Yeah, but if you ask for bail, you ask for a judicial, you know, review for... Yeah, then there's a potential, if you are convicted, that you can claim up to 1.5 days. So So that's important to know. That is a strategy that, you know, we're trying to get it out as widely as possible, but also we're afraid to say, I'll tell you why we're not writing it and why you're not seeing missives coming out from us, because if they figure out that that's a, quote, loophole, guess how quickly that'll be shoved up. So we want to make sure that everybody who's working with individuals inside know that. So 75% of the people in custody aren't even convicted of anything. And so we can wipe out, you know, we can put them in segregation for longer, we can wipe out their rights, we can wipe out their access to counsel because, you know, we've also cut legal aid, so they're less likely to have representation. If they're women and their kids get taken into care because they're held in custody, in some provinces now, if a child is in temporary care for 3 months or 6 months in some provinces, they can automatically be put into permanent care. So if you're a woman awaiting trial, you wonder why so many are pleading guilty and hopes that they'll get out before that 3 month period elapses and maybe try and get their kids back. So the other way that women are being criminalized, because many women will describe the worst thing about custody is not the sentence. They're not minimizing the sentence, but the worst thing is the separation and now sometimes permanent separation from their children. Because once they're in permanent care, they have no access to them at all. And so even if they can show they tried, they can't get legal aid. If nobody will represent them in family court, there's no one to represent their interests. And it used to be, we fought for years to have it be recognized that just because someone is in prison doesn't mean she's a bad mother. In fact, you know, once testifying in frustration, and I used the example that my son, Michael, he started going into prison as a baby, and so did Madison. She was 2 weeks old the first time she went into a prison. And when Michael was three, we were in the prison for women, and he, you know, we were standing in the breezeway, sort of this connecting limestone, and all of the women started filing down from one of the units, living units, for lunch. And he looked up at me and said, "Mummy, where are all the mummies going?" And, you know, I use that example to articulate, this is, you know, I couldn't brainwash this kid to say that. I couldn't make him think that. That's how he experienced all the women at the prison for women in Kingston, that they were the mummies. And, you know, he learned, you know, just a brief aside, but he, you know, he learned to cook there. Those of you who know me know I'm not much of a cook, you know. My kids cook better than I do. He learned to dance the Macarena. He learned to sing karaoke. He learned how to work a video game. He was Santa's helper and would go up to segregation. I mean, his experience of the women was as mummies, not as prisoners, not even as women first. He experienced them as that. So, you know, the fact that there's any presumption that just because someone's been criminalized, you can then interfere with their rights or their or characterize them as not being capable of mothering is, of course, ludicrous. I mean, I don't need to say that to you. Any of you here, but now we've seen for the past 10 years it introduced again as a reason why women should lose access even to their children because they have been criminalized and therefore cannot be a good role model at the very least and certainly can't be good mothers if they're criminalized. So we're in a situation where we've rolled into a place that is, I wouldn't even say back, it's a place that, you know, many of us could never have predicted. And so we see the criminalization of Indigenous women in particular, where I'm told by people in corrections their own estimates, which of course they can't release anymore, and I can't even get the information sometimes through access to information. Some of you know it took us 3 years to get Ashley Smith's records after she asked us to get them, and where I'm in the process right now of trying to get basic information about the numbers of people in prison, the numbers in segregation. We have our numbers, we're collecting them each month when we go in, and the numbers of uses of force, the numbers of times that women have been shackled, the number of times they're gassed, the number of times that they have, the number of bed days that they're segregated, how many are double bunked, basic information that the government has. And when we're trying to get that information, I was told, of course they have it, but they're not allowed to give it to me. Every time they meet with us, they have to get ministerial approval to have a meeting with us. So we were told that they can't give us the information, but they have it. Do an access to information request. I just did the third access to information request for that. It's cost us already over $1,500. Imagine if you're a prisoner trying to get that. information and you can't get access to it. And I don't know when, if and when we'll get access to it. I mean, when we do, of course, they know we're going to publicize it, and that's part of the reason, no doubt, that it's being delayed, and they hope that we'll go away. But so we're, but it, within corrections, they're saying by the end of this decade, more than half of the women serving federal sentences will be Indigenous women, and the majority will be racialized women. The number with mental health issues identified by corrections will probably be close to 50%. So who are we jailing? Why are we jailing? Our jails are becoming the default for all the cuts to social programs, healthcare, educational programs, and they're becoming not just warehouses, but places of brutalization and punishment.
An industry,
yes, the prison industrial complex, which of course there's a lot written about. So, so that's part of why, to answer your question, sorry, a long answer, to why women are the fastest growing prison population. So when you're hearing now the numbers of men in custody has gone down, that's true, but the numbers of women have not. And every single prison for women in this country is overcrowded right now. All of the maximum security units except Nova Institution in the Atlantic region are double bunked. So you can imagine those who have the greatest challenges to survive in custody are being put in the most egregious living conditions. And so we're likely to see, I mean, we've already seen some of the challenges. So one of the things we're trying to do is get key cases to and get court challenges. So some of you know we're just in court about, with Nicole Ryan, or Doucette as she's known, about her self-defense and the fact that she was criminalized after police refused to come when she was calling. We're involved in the some challenges to the grievance system. We've got human rights complaints in on behalf of all women to the Human Rights Commission. So we're trying to use those mechanisms as well as a whole training process to that if in fact they succeed in, you know, some of you know we've been barred from the prison at times and are still trying to get back into parts of segregation and the max unit since Ashley Smith's death. Now, in October, that'll be 5 years. And, you know, while it's, you know, I mean, we need to be getting back in, and so we're continuing to use those mechanisms to get in. But we're also working on creating tools so that those inside have access themselves to the information, so they're not reliant on those of us outside to be advocating.
Can they have the guide?
Yes,
they can have it.
They can have
Francophones too?
Apparently now they can. So what Michelle's raising is, for a while, the here in Joliet, they had the English guide, and luckily most of the women could speak English, but they wouldn't allow the French one in. Guess why? Because suddenly the staff read it. Now, you know, lest you think we were doing something subversive, not that I haven't done subversive things, but this was not. We knew to get a booklet in, you're going to have to get it through. So we sent it to corrections. We asked for their response. Went back. Ontario, we just got it in. Ontario, the provincial one. So there's a Quebec provincial and a Quebec federal guide. It's called Human Rights in Action. Some of you have seen the booklets. There, it was a purposeful, you know, little things sometimes amuse me, but I wanted to draw attention to the inaction on human rights issues and the fact that women were getting into action, so we called it Human Rights in Action. You know, two words, not one word of what corrections was doing. So those guides have gone into the prisons, and not just that, but we're about to go do another train the trainer where women who have been outside, who have themselves been criminalized, are now being allowed to go back in. And we now actually have some, we're not publicizing it a lot because it's something we don't want to get cut, but some of the institutions, they have actually allowed women to work as advocates inside and be accountable back to the group of the Human Rights in Action group. So it, you know, different parts, they're more active than others, but so women are being educating themselves and educating others and educating law students. So one of the things we're doing with law students is taking them in, not so that they can educate, but so that they can be educated. And so I've just agreed, the students at Ottawa, you asked for us to do another prison law course, and we're doing one. Part of that is that they need to be educated by people who have the lived experience and know. And so, and just to give you an idea, I mean, some of the law students, after they finished part of the one of the first visits came out, and they had just been meeting with a woman who was in maximum security, who at the time we were that particular warden is very supportive of this initiative, is someone who has, you know, would probably be fired if they thought she was doing this, so I won't say where she is, but she was very supportive of having the women have access to not just the human rights, but that they should be putting more grievances, should be challenging. And in fact, the union rep, the guards union, was also in favor of this. And so, of course, it makes it much easier if you have internal support for this. And basically, we're urging that we expose what was happening. And so when one of the women wanted to meet with the law students, she was permitted to do so. And I went and talked to her and said, are you sure? Because she was in a security gown. And any of you have seen those gowns know what they look like. Gown is a euphemism, of course. But it was, you know, there. It's a like a moving blanket or a horse blanket, depending on your orient, you know, what you know. And it has a hole for the head, a hole for the arms, slides over. They come in three sizes to fit all prisoners, men, women. And so, you know, you can imagine. And this is a woman who was not very big. And so the fact that she had to come out with fully shackled and with her cuff behind her back meant that her breasts would be exposed. And so I said, you know, you recognize if you come out to meet, they're probably not going to let us provide any other covering. She goes, ah, I don't care. I'd like to have some company. And so she came out, and, you know, we did our best to try and cover her up as she could. And the students, who were all women law students, were horrified and afterwards said, you know, that they actually had the guts to say, one of them, I didn't actually believe half the stories you told. And I'm ashamed to say it, because I thought you must have been exaggerating, until they saw and heard from this woman herself. And so obviously that is an education, that if people think I'm exaggerating these, I don't need to tell you folks who are doing this, but we need to be exposing more of the realities to individuals. And so we're trying to do things also to open up the prisons to have more people coming in. And you know, one of the things I would not have ever imagined when I started this work that I again talk a lot about, and it's just recently there's been a new change to this, is if someone had told me that on a weekly basis I would start to get this year, this is the first year it's happened, more calls from people working inside the system exposing what's happening than prisoners, partly because prisoners are having less access to the phones, but nevertheless, I would have said, if that's true and I'm still doing this work, then you should fire me, because it would mean that I've like sold out, I've gone over to the other side, because, you know, that's the only way staff would be calling me. I hope that's not what I've done, but I put it out there just in case you see that, then you can call me to account. But what's really happening is people inside are feeling disempowered. You can only imagine what prisoners must be feeling if the people inside feel they can't do anything about it and are actually trying to get action. So, you know, before Ashley Smith's death, I had started to get people saying, why aren't you suing us? After her death, they were saying, why aren't you taking on the whole system? And I, you know, it's a great idea. At the time, they cut legal aid, got, you know, it's hard to get lawyers to do this stuff. All the people I went to law school with go running the other way when they see me coming now, because they know that I'm looking for more free representation. I'm joking a bit, but, you know, seriously. But so, you know, the reality is that we're at a time when, you know, we have more sympathetic people inside, but they're terrified. So that now, I'm actually, the minute I walk into a prison, I can almost be guaranteed that I'll be just as, I'll have the staff coming up to me, not as much. That's a very gross exaggeration, but I'll have the staff approaching me about individual women's cases, systemic issues, and they'll be saying, you know, could you come over here? And there'll be three or four of them, because they don't want to be singled out as who's actually told me something about what's happening in the prison. And so we're seeing that kind of phenomenon. So I actually do believe things will start to change, because I don't think this can be maintained, you know, unless they fire all of these individuals and hire, you know, a bunch of thugs to come in, quite frankly. And of course there are some people who are not sympathetic, and there are some people who hassle us all the time. And there, you know, some prisons there's more of those. I mean, not mentioning any names like RPC, for instance, but there are some where it's particularly bad, and where they are, you know, the staff are clearly still of an ilk that they think that they can wield incredible power in incredibly punitive and brutal ways. And so I'm next next week, in fact, on my way out to RPC, because we've had more incidents of women being chemically and physically restrained and assaulted. And some of you will know that Ashley Smith had, you know, the first, my first contact with her was, I was being asked by other women to go in and see her, and then by some staff to go in and see her, because she had been, there were allegations she had been assaulted. And in fact, she, you know, so the guy was acquitted, and so too were never charged, but I will, you know, never doubt that she was assaulted by those staff, and by another one at Nova who never even got investigated. And so, so we know that happens all the time. And so one of the strategies as well is to try to get that information out and to keep publicizing it. And one of the things that I got challenged with several times this past year is that I was going to be sued for defamation. I said, bring it on. You know, you bring a defamation, you got to prove that I'm wrong and that I'm telling, you know, I'm purposely lying about this. And, you know, and so, you know, that's the reality. That's, you know, the bully tactics are going to increase for those of us doing advocacy.
And from where does it come?
Well, I guess the most interesting one was from the MPs who would say it in House of Commons. I mean, some of you remember there was some publicity about it when I talked about women experiencing strip searching as sexual assault by the state, and so they said that I was calling male guards rapists and but wouldn't say it outside the House of Commons because they're protected by parliamentary privilege when they're in the House of Commons. They can't be sued. If he had said it the minute he came out of Parliament, then I could have sued him, you know. Would have loved to have sued him, but they, and so that whole debate happened inside, and every media outlet agreed to do a debate between us. His name is Rath Gerber. He's a member of Parliament from Edmonton, and so Mr. Rath Gerber had said that I was alleging that guards were raping and that they had sexual motives for doing strip searches, and you know, I mean, just. Anyway, so those kinds of things happen, but, you know, I mean, not that you don't take them seriously, but the reality is it's easy to dismiss them if there's nonsense, and most of them are nonsense. I mean, right now, Human Rights Watch International has just agreed to do a separate investigation of that whole issue with Justice for Girls out in British Columbia, because similar sorts of things are happening with girls, and they were being threatened, and now they've been locked out of most of the youth institutions in British Columbia as a result, and RCMP have tried to go after them, and so, you know, we're having people requesting copies of lifers, you know, all their computers, and I mean, so whenever anything like that is happening, one of the things to be letting all of the individuals, you know, who have records, particularly those who are still on parole, is that any of those kinds of requests, there has to be a policy basis for it. And the simplest way to put it is, the law is that when someone is sentenced to imprisonment, the separation from community is the sentence. Anything that further limits your freedom is either not allowed or there are laws or rules about how to do it. And if they're allowed to do it, then you're entitled to know what they're entitled to do and how they're entitled to do it. So if they say, for instance, like they did to several lifers recently, we want to know all the people you're associating with. My response was, ask them for the policy and why. You're entitled to know not just what the policy is, but why for you in particular they want to know that. And when they gave some reasons, which were, you know, not really legitimate, we said, okay, a group of us, all lawyers, gave our names and said, tell them we're your friend. I mean, we are your friends too, but just give these names and tell them that's who you're associating with. And guess what? Did they investigate further? Did they come do an assessment of me? No. So we need to be asking for those policies, developing those alliances, and setting up some processes to help protect people. So
there is no non-association policy that's set in stone for everybody out on parole?
No, there isn't. But what's interesting is for women, one of the things I have started to see is a relationship clause. So women on parole, many, in fact, there are very few that I know of right now who don't have relationship clause. And what I mean by that is that they're supposed to report every relationship that they have, particularly a sexual relationship, to their parole officer. So my response is ask what that means for your parole officer. Is that, you know, you're interested in someone, it's a date, it's you've had sex with them, like what is it? You know, and so then I thought at the same time as this was happening, I put in a request to find out how many of those conditions actually existed for men on parole and how many for women. Guess what my response is? We're still fighting it, actually. Guess what my response is? No. No, the response is there are so many conditions that we don't keep track of. It would take us, the parole board said, it would take us 6 years to research this, so we can't do it. It's an unreasonable request. Correctional Service of Canada says, we don't know, so we can't even imagine how long it would take, so it's an unreasonable request. The information commissioner said that's reasonable for them to say that because they haven't actually come up with an administrative way to keep track of that properly. So I'm thinking, okay, so everybody who has that, I want them to know that. So the next time the parole board is looking at why they've applied this, they need to have the rationale in place so that we can, and if they end up having to go to court about it, that they have that kind of documentation that it's not even clear why they're keeping it and what is the value of it. If it was a valuable provision, they would be tracking it and saying, we do this because this prevents X, Y, or Z, or this has caught so many people, or whatever it is. It's clearly just a control thing. So I'm not saying they won't get it. In fact, many will. But it's possible then to try and put some brakes on it, if not challenge it completely. I mean, in some cases, if it's someone who has, you know, all the women who have killed in self-defense or who have reacted to violence, all of them have those provisions. Well, actually, that's not true. We managed to get it off two women, but all but those two that I know have them. And so they're required to report. But those are the sorts of things we need to be challenging. So it's as simple as you don't have to be a lawyer to know it. You just have to know that if it limits your freedom any more than the actual separation from society, there's a rule about it, and you're entitled to know it, or they're not allowed to do it.